Ladies and gents, welcome to another episode of Optimize Your Body Podcast. I've got my man Andreas Einfeld. Oh, please say I pronounced that right. I should be testing these words out before I jump on. Is it Einfeld? Is that how you pronounce it?
Well, if you're a Swede, you'd say Einfeld.
Einfeld.
That's a bit tricky, I think.
There we go. Einfeld. Okay, that's easier.
It's good enough.
Okay, I'll take that. So we got Andreas Einfeld here. And Andreas is a Swedish doctor specializing in family medicine, and he's an advocate for the low carbohydrates, high fat diets, and has criticized the saturated fat guidelines in the past. Einfeld was born in 1972 and graduated from medical school at Uppsala. Is it Uppsala University? Uppsala? Okay, you can pronounce that afterwards.
That's perfect.
Okay, fantastic. A few years later, he started dietdoctor.com, a website focused on low carbohydrates diets. And during the last 10 years, Dr. Einfeld has authored the biggest health blog in Sweden and a number one best-selling book on nutrition that's been translated to 8 languages, including English. He may be partly responsible for a butter shortage in the past in his home country. And one of his presentations on low carb has been viewed on YouTube millions of times. It said 4.5 million, but I think it's way more than that on YouTube. Anyway, before I go into depth and read out a novel here, Andreas, how you doing, man? How you doing over there in Stockholm?
I'm excellent. Thank you for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Completely butchered that intro there. Pronunciation wasn't the best, but I did my best. So thanks for your patience.
No, it's good. I think that sort of an online thing is a little bit out of date, but that's all right.
All good.
More interesting stuff to talk about in the podcast, perhaps.
For sure. Yeah, I just realized then I didn't have a bio, so I made the mistake of going on Wikipedia. I'm like, this is really dated, but there we go. But
I guess I need to do more exciting things so someone updates my Wikipedia page.
All good. So I'd love to know, Andreas, just basically, before we get into the thick of things, I'd love to know what inspired you to get on this incredible journey that you've been on in terms of, you know, low carb diets, you know, keto, and really just this journey of health and nutrition. What inspired you to get into it and just, you know, make it, I don't even want to just say a career, but like have such a big impact on the world with what you're doing. What gave you that inspiration?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started with just being a young, just out of medical school doctor, and then starting diving into this rabbit hole, really, where I realized that people can transform their health by just changing what they eat. And really, this is not something we are taught much about in medical school. We're taught about, you know, procedures, medications, etc. But people don't tend to get well from sort of chronic diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, etc., etc. You don't get well from them by taking medications. You just have to take it every day for the rest of your life. So pretty fascinating to see that something I've never been really taught about in medical school just seemed to work so remarkably well for some people. So I just got obsessed with this and, you know, tried to learn everything I could, and eventually trying to find ways to not just help a few patients, but is this possible to do at scale? So, you know, 15, 17 years ago, started the blog, it became really popular, and then, you know, a book, and yeah, it just snowballed from there. And then suddenly I'm not a clinical doctor anymore. I'm an entrepreneur trying to, you know, bring support to people at scale online, making it simple to eat better is really what it's been about since the beginning, because it's really hard to do that today. It's really hard for people to improve their eating, improve their life through lifestyle changes. I mean, people can do it for a short time, but it's very challenging. So that's still what I'm passionate about. You know, how do we make it really, really simple so that it can benefit many, many more people? Because we have this huge epidemic of obesity and diabetes and related diseases in the world. Like 93% of the adult US population have poor metabolic health. This drives all our top chronic diseases, shortens our lives, reduces quality of life. It's really the biggest health problem in the world, I'd say. And it's all primarily caused by this new modern food environment we all live in. So quite a challenge and extremely exciting, I think. Really rewarding to be part of trying to make a difference. I mean, a lot of people are, and it's good to be part of that.
Making food and nutrition simple. That's it. Yeah. It's funny you say that, because that is the most common feedback I get as a coach from clients who sign up or reach out, is it's so confusing with all the information out there. And not only is it confusing, it's also conflicting. So you get an opposite, and then people end up confused and overwhelmed, right? So I think what you're doing is awesome. And at the moment, tell us a bit more about what you're doing right now. I wanted to get into like the Harbor app and stuff like that. We'll maybe cover more of that at the end. But tell us a bit more about what you're doing now, because I know you're working with Dr. Ted Nyman, who I had on for the second time last week.
So, yeah, Ted's awesome.
Yeah, I'd love to know more about. Yeah, oh yeah. Ted is awesome.
So, I mean, I came into this through the low-carb route, right? And low-carb is something that works really well for a lot of people. And there is a lot of science showing that that's exactly what it can do. It can help people lose weight, improve their metabolic health, etc. But what I've been sort of diving into in the last 5+ years is that, even though low carb seems to work really well for a lot of people, there are also other people who do well on high carb diets, high protein diets, even, you know, plant-based diets that can be quite high in unrefined carbs can help people. So how do you reconcile that? And it ties back to what you were talking about, this confusion that people feel, all these conflicting advice from people heading different sort of dietary tribes, and these things are often like completely opposed. You know, avoid all meat or eat only meat, and both groups seem to be, you know, talking about how great they feel. It's just it's hard to reconcile, I think, for a lot of people. But I think that there is a way to make it simple, and that's what we're pursuing now, me and Ted and our little group of missionaries here. It's a way to take all this complexity and boil it down to one framework. The point is really that it's not just about one thing, it's about multiple things. But with modern technology, you can all feed this into an algorithm and get a simplified number one scale out of all of this. Like, for example, it seems that low carb works really well, but probably for a multitude of reasons, like it tends to be higher in protein, you tend to avoid processed, ultra-processed foods, highly rewarding foods, all these most highly rewarding foods all disappear, like ice cream, chocolate, potato chips, everything is out, right, on a low-carb diet. So you basically exclude all these hyper-palatable foods. And then you end up with a diet that is unprocessed and high in protein and nutrients, at least for most people. Okay, so no surprise, it works. But you can kind of do the opposite. You can go on a plant-based diet, which is high in carbs. And now you're excluding most high-fat foods, so you actually end up with a higher protein percentage anyways. And you also avoid all the highly rewarding ultra-processed foods, ideally, potentially. You can end up with something that works. So yeah, what we've been doing is trying to work together with some of the leading experts in the world on trying to figure out what are the top evidence-based, science-based factors that really govern how much food makes us want to eat. And then how can we fit that into a pretty complex by now algorithm so that the customer, or you or I, we don't have to look at 10 numbers or 20 numbers, every ingredient in every food ingredient that we use. It just becomes unmanageable. What if we can boil it down to just one number, one scale, and then have a app, a tool that can help us, guide us to more satiating foods, basically more nourishing foods? I think that's the holy grail, and that's what we're pursuing.
That is the holy grail, right? High satiety, eating foods which keep you satiated and stop you overeating. It's funny because as you're speaking, Andreas, right, I'm like, it's so simple. On paper, it's so simple, but behavior change is actually very complex, right? And with those ultra-processed foods, they're designed to make us overeat. So I love what you guys are doing, and you're fitting it into an algorithm, and you're simplifying not only what foods to eat, but you're also putting together the right combinations and stuff. Tell us a bit more about how that works in terms of, because if the algorithm is one thing and it's going to be individualized to the person, but then also it's also doing that based on the fundamentals people need to focus on, right? And you mentioned one of the fundamentals being high satiety.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely fundamental. But the point is that satiety is made up of many things, or satiety per calorie. So I think that the biggest mistake that we've all made, or experts have made, I certainly have made back in the days, is to focus on calories. You say obesity or being not obese or being at a good weight, it's all about calories, calories in, calories out. And you know, while that may be true in a very theoretical sense, it doesn't really help people much in the long term, because just eating less and running more, if you keep eating the same foods that got you to become obese, then you're going to want to eat more. You're going to want to eat the same amount. So just voluntarily trying to eat less, well, you can do it for a day, you can do it for a week, but eventually you're just going to be tired, hungry, and miserable, with cravings getting worse and worse and worse. It's just a recipe for failure. And this is kind of what the food industry wants us to believe, because it's highly profitable, right? If it's all about calories, then you can eat whatever you want. Then the food industry is not to blame for selling you foods that cause you to eat more. It's all your fault, right? The blame is with you, and the food industry is, you know, they're not to blame, right? So it's great for them. And also this confusion that, you know, as long as people just are confused and fail over and over again, they're just going to give up, and they're going to keep eating, keep buying, and then they are profitable consumers, right? So I think the food industry has a lot of incentive. I'm not trying to be conspiratorial here. It's just pure market economics. They make money by selling more foods, right? So if they can construct foods that cause you to eat more, then you will buy more. And if they can keep you confused and not understanding what's going on, then they will keep making money every day, every week, every year. It's just incentives. It's just, I mean, they're smart people. They have their job is to make money for their shareholders, and they do.
And all they think is, how can we make these foods as highly palatable as possible to sell more product? Nothing else.
How can we make more money?
Yeah.
Well, you do it by selling more.
Absolutely.
And you sell more by making it more irresistible and harder to stop eating.
100%. I'd like to pick your brain on the low carb diets and keto. I'd like to go down that road. And what made you realize that the low carb diet and, you know, maybe being fueled more by fat was so effective? And why do you think people do seem to get, depending on the person, of course, a lot of progress when they take that approach? And it does depend on the person. Some people do better high carbs, as you say, it depends on the person. But generally, from what I've seen, when people cut out a lot of the processed foods, going back to what we were saying, they eat more whole foods, generally they do better. But especially when it's low carb and kind of higher protein, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I got into it through that. I've been on some version of a low carb diet now for more than 20 years. I guess it's 22 now. So I've seen it effect on myself and, you know, friends and family, and certainly my patients. And there's also a ton of science showing that this can work quite well when people do it. I mean, when I got into it, I was buying this hypothesis that, hey, this is all due to carbs raising the blood glucose, and that raises the fat storing hormone insulin, and then you get into fat storage mode, and that's how it goes. And if you avoid the carbs, then lower insulin and, you know, fat burning, and then you lose weight. It's a very attractive, logical, beautiful hypothesis. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be entirely true. Like, it's maybe partially true, but it's certainly not the whole story.
So what would you say, just for the audience, Andreas, what is the difference between keto and low carb? Because I do see a lot of people get confused sometimes. They say they're going to kind of eat keto. To actually get your body into ketosis is kind of it's not a simple thing to do, right? And you have to be aware of how you're getting your body into ketosis and how many carbohydrates you need, how much fat you need, and everything else. What is the difference between the two?
Yeah, I would say keto is a simple way to say it. It's just more a strict version of low carb. It's a lower carb, even lower carb diet. So like you said, you get into ketosis, which is what happens when you eat less carbohydrates than your body needs for fuel. Then it switches to an alternative fuel supply. It makes something called ketones, which is an energy molecule in the blood, out of fat. And then the brain is run on these ketones. because the brain can't be run on fat directly. So it's like an indirect route. Fat goes to the liver, gets converted to ketones, and become fuel for your brain, which may have some benefits for some people. Epilepsy can improve, possibly other mental health things in some cases can improve as well. It's an interesting area of research. But primarily, I think for most people, it's just, okay, now my fat burning is going to be much higher. I am going to run my brain on fat as well. The brain is a hungry organ. It means more fat burning, and then people think they will lose more weight, which is possible. But then if you eat a high fat diet, you may end up eating all the fat you burn, and then you're not losing weight, right? So I think it depends. I think people most people are realizing now that, or maybe have realized for a long time, that keto diet is not necessarily more effective. It depends on how you do it. And if you overdo the fat, well, then you're eating all the fat you're burning, maybe more, and then you're not losing weight, right? So it's just because you're burning more fat doesn't mean you necessarily lose weight. It also depends on how much you put into your system.
And also what's sustainable as well, right? I think that's the key thing. You know what I mean? It's like, what can the person sustain? That's a big massive factor that people struggle with, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you need significant benefits in your life from a health perspective to stay on a ketogenic diet for a long time, because it is challenging.
And with low carb, right? Do you see people, because sometimes something might be labeled low carb, and then they might obviously keep going for low carb foods, but essentially then they could be missing out on certain types of fats and other sources of energy, and essentially maybe just not having complete meals, which then could leave them less satiated and eating maybe not as well. I know that depends, but do you feel like do you see any mistakes people make when they try and go low carb? Is anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think that the main mistake people make on low carb is overdoing it on the fat, especially if their goal is weight loss and improving metabolic health, like type 2 diabetes, etc. Thinking that fat is sort of a free food, or at least benign in a low insulin state on a low carb diet. So overdoing it on the fat, I think, slows down the progress for a lot of people, or even reverses it. That's I think the main thing. And connected to that, perhaps, is that, well, if you don't overdo the fat, if you're a little bit cautious about the fat as well, then actually you may be able to handle some unrefined, fiber-rich carbohydrates just fine. So that in a way, if you eat a high fat diet, then that makes it so that you have to stay very, very low carb to get the results you want. But it may actually be easier and more flexible for a lot of people to switch that a little bit, reduce the added fats. I mean, certainly eat foods with fat in them, like, you know, meat, eggs, fish, etc. You know, real foods with fat in them, I think, is generally a great idea to eat. But reducing perhaps the added fats, the oils, the butter, reducing that to a level that it's just what you need to be happy and enjoy life, and not more than that. Then you get more flexibility on the other side with the carbohydrates. I think that becomes a more sustainable approach for most people in the long term.
100%. And with added fats, you hit the nail on the head. Having foods which already contain fat, maybe essential fats like you get in meat, for example, eggs. But when people start adding, and I know it was a big one, is cheese. People add in cheese, they can just eat so much of it. And as you say, the oils creep up, all the calories. Fat's the most calorie-dense macronutrient, right? So people think, that's a really good point. I'm glad you made that point, because it's so simple, so easy to do, very easy to do. With carbohydrates, though, not all carbs are treated equally, right, Andreas? So is there any advice you would give to listeners in terms of, I don't want you to list out a whole bunch of different foods. Obviously, you're not going to do that, because you've said it a few times. It depends, right? And that's what someone's going to say when it comes to this nutrition stuff. It really depends on a lot of different factors. It's multifactorial. But not all carbs are treated equally, right, Andreas?
No, absolutely not. I think that the thing that that matters is really how processed, how refined is it. We talk about, you know, pure sugar, white flour, etc. isn't great, obviously. That's pretty much what everybody says. The interesting thing is why. Why is that? And you can see some factors, like you remove all the fiber from it. That seems to be a significant factor. Another factor that is very, very significant, maybe even more so, is the energy density of food. And I don't think we would talk enough about energy density. It's sort of there are a lot of studies actually showing the effect of it, like how many calories per weight of food, how concentrated the calories are, basically how much fluid or fiber is in it, and pretty much all ultra processed foods, they are very, very high in energy density. In fact, seems to be maybe one of the biggest factors. It's probably, well, with our satiety approach, we look at four factors, and the three big ones are protein percentage, energy density, and the sort of hedonic nature of food, like how addictive it is. And all of these tend to be going in the wrong direction with ultra processed foods, and carbohydrates is one example of that. If you remove all the fiber, all the fluid, you get really concentrated carbs. Like, for example, if you go to bread or white bread or something like a donut or candy, etc., it's very, very concentrated carbohydrates. So, and that tends to make people eat much, much more, much faster before the body has the time to react and say, I'm full. You can eat 1,000 calories before you know it, you know, or 2,000.
Easy. And the rest. Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And it obviously makes a difference as well in terms of the combinations of foods, right? So when it comes to blood sugar levels, I know you mentioned energy density then. So you said energy density, you mentioned the protein percentage and the hedonic value of foods, right? They're the kind of three big rocks, you would say, that you guys
talk about. I think those are the three big ones. And then fiber is a smaller rock in the jar.
Got it. So that comes down then to the blood sugar spike as well, right? So when you're having, I guess, more fiber and whole foods, maybe more single ingredient foods or not foods, which are going to give you a big spike or high concentration of carbohydrates, then you might get a balanced blood sugar kind of spike. Or if you're combining them with certain foods, does that make a difference as well? Because, you know, I haven't actually done it myself, but I do have friends who've used a blood glucose monitor, and they've noticed that obviously the combination of foods make a massive difference. So if they had some honey, for example, on its own, massive blood sugar spike, really hungry, easier to eat more. But if they had that with a meal, different story, you know? But I know it depends.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of CGMs. Sure, they can be helpful, but I think they can also be misleading because, I mean, they're all hyped up now because, you know, to be frank, people are making a lot of money from these products.
They're not cheap at all, bloody hell.
So not saying it's useless, for sure not. I mean, it can be helpful, used in the right way, absolutely, and it's a cool technology. The problem I see with it is that it puts the spotlight so heavily on the blood glucose, on the carbohydrate side, that we tend to kind of ignore the other side of the coin, the other macronutrient that brings us empty calories potentially, which is added fats. I mean, what these CGMs teach people to do in the worst case is that focusing on these blood glucose spikes makes people forget about the effect of the added fats, because actually the more fat you add on top of foods, the lower the blood glucose spike will be. But it will not be helpful for you if you want to avoid poor metabolic health and obesity. Just pouring oil on everything is a disaster. I mean, we know that from not least from animal studies. You pour oil on top of animal foods, every animal gets obese from that. Pretty much the same thing seems to happen to humans too. So I think some caution is advised there. It's also another thing that bothers me a bit is if you're on a very low carb diet for a significant amount of time, let's say a few weeks or more, then you develop physiological insulin resistance. You basically get very, very sensitive to small amounts of carbohydrates. You get a blood glucose spike from almost anything, like a handful of blueberries. Maybe you get a blood glucose spike now. And I think this kind of locks people into a strict low carb approach, even if they maybe don't really need it. They get concerned and worried about eating some berries, but they're potentially getting 100 times more empty calories from added fats, which they can't see. And yeah, I just don't think it's necessarily a great place to be, honestly. But again, with that caveat, I do think that CGMs, these continuous monitors, can be helpful if you know how to use it. Just watch out for the risks.
That's such a good point. And it can be good just to get more awareness, I guess, right? But I never really thought about that, because I can imagine people getting obsessed with how can I get my blood sugar levels not to crash as much, et cetera, but then ignoring the fact that they might be adding bunch of loads of oils and loads of calories and sometimes empty calories, right, from fats.
Yeah, and also the fact that if you're on a very strict low-carb diet, you will become very, very sensitive to carbs compared to someone who is used to eating carbs. And that what you see as a spike now may actually be due to the fact that you are on a very, very low-carb diet. You are very sensitive to carbs now. But eat a little bit more carbs for a few more days, for a few days, and your body adapts to it. And now those blueberries will not give you a spike anymore. So it's just very interesting. And I think people are maybe not aware enough about that.
100%. Really good point. Listen up. I've got a huge opportunity. This is exclusive just for people watching or listening to this podcast. I'm going to be offering four people 25% discount on Optimize Your Body 90-day coaching program, right? So what you can expect to achieve within 90 days is you're going to drop around about 4 to 6 kilos of fat, build lean muscle, and really build structure and routine. You're going to work closely with me. You're going to have access to our thriving community, and you're literally going to get into the shape of your life. This will be life-changing for you if you're ready to commit and become the best version of yourself. The best way is just simply drop me a direct message on Instagram with the word info and we'll take it from there. Or you can just send me an email to admin@optimizeyourbody.com. Or also in the show notes, we have our website where you can see some of our awesome transformations. And we also have a coaching inquiry form as well, if you prefer to do it that way. So don't miss out on this massive opportunity. Thanks for listening. And with metabolic flexibility, what is your thoughts on this term of metabolic flexibility in terms of metabolic health, people being healthy, maybe just in general, right? It could even be relating to weight loss. In other words, having variety and not going maybe low carb for too long. You know what I mean? Like, and actually kind of mixing it up in a sense with the way you're eating, especially with your fats and carbs. What do you think of that term, metabolic flexibility? Do you think it's important people to be aware of that if people are looking to just be metabolically healthy and perform well?
I mean, I think for most people that should be the... That would be the more sustainable approach. I'm not necessarily against people going very low carb for a long time if they feel well doing that and reach their goals. I think that that's probably a valid approach. I've certainly done that, and I think a lot of people have been successful doing that. But I think flexibility is probably more sustainable for more people. It gives you more variety in life, gives you the opportunity to eat more different kinds of foods. And I don't think you necessarily lose much, if anything, when it comes to metabolic health and weight control, etc. As long as you make sure that the protein percentage of what you eat is high, and you keep the energy density down, and you avoid ultra processed, sort of hyper palatable foods, I think that most people can do fine with some flexibility, get some fat, some carbs, mostly fat and carbs from within foods. Not so much refined, concentrated, added oils or sugar or refined flour, etc. Keep away from those things, and I think most people would do really well on that.
Awesome. So just to give people more of an insight into, you know, sustainable weight loss, people are thinking, I want to improve the way my body looks. I want to get lean and stay lean, right, Andreas? That's what I want to do. So you mentioned the three big rocks. Talk us through the fundamentals. Just to kind of because it's very simple. You've broken it down in a simple way, just for people who want to get lean and stay lean and get metabolically as healthy as possible.
Yeah, I think the number one thing is for most people would be to increase the protein. So that means eating more of high protein foods. That could be meat, fish, and eggs and dairy, but you could also get it from if you're more plant based, you can get it more from legumes, beans, lentils. Soy products. You can get it from concentrated protein foods, like, of course, protein powders in various forms, or protein shakes. You can get it from other sort of plant-based foods, like seitan and so forth. Yeah, more protein, and then connected to that, reducing the amount of added fats and refined carbohydrates, so that you're percentage of protein really goes up. And if you track, which I think is really helpful, I mean, studies show that people who track what they eat, the more people track, the more weight they tend to lose, and the more successful they tend to be. So if you track these things, then I think at least getting your protein percentage above 20 would be like a baseline, which would be probably good for anybody. If you can get it to 30, you get an even more powerful effect. And for some more extreme people, get it past 40 for spectacular results when it comes to body composition.
Awesome. And is it true when it comes to protein that it's more important to actually hit a target, a percentage, than it is the types of protein you're eating? That would be the most important thing, I guess.
I mean, I think this is hotly debated. I would say from a simplicity point of view, I think looking at the protein percentage is more helpful, because if you're just looking at a gram amount, then yeah, you might get a lot of protein, but if you get it together with excessive amounts of fat or carbohydrates, well, then you're just overeating in general, and you may not reach your goals. So personally, I think that the simplest way to do it is to learn which foods are high in protein percentage, and then just eat more of those, and then just eat as much as you want. And then you don't have to care about grams or calories or anything, really. You just have to learn which foods work well for you and eat more of them.
Yeah.
I think that's just easier and more enjoyable.
It is much more enjoyable and much more sustainable as well. You mentioned about the energy density. Just to clarify for the audience as well, you mean essentially the amount of calories in it. So for example, if you had a bunch of vegetables or potatoes or whatever on a plate, it's kind of high volume, but low in energy density. But if you had, like you said, a donut, high in calories, high energy density and compact and concentrated carbohydrates as well, right?
So yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like the difference between boiled potatoes or potato chips. The potato chips are all dehydrated and deep fried and massively high in energy density, while the potatoes are full of fluid and fiber and such. So what do you think you will eat more of? If you eat boiled potatoes until you're full or potato chips until you're full, probably three times more calories with the potato chips.
Easy. Yeah, easy. No problem. What would you say? I didn't want to ask this question, right, Andres, but I'd love to see how you answer. I'm just curious. What would you say if someone said to you, right, what's the best diet for weight loss, Andres? What is the best diet?
Yeah, I would say it's a high satiety per calorie diet, which includes all of these factors. And the easiest way to do it that I know of is to use our approach when we have free tools on our website on hava.co, and have a free trial on our app. Because this is a simple score that or a guide that includes all of these various factors. But of course, you can take the factors one by one, and you can say, I'm going to eat higher protein percentage foods. That is, we know that's effective for weight loss. I'm going to eat less processed, less energy dense foods that are less addictive. Yeah, you can do all of these things on your own separately. I think that combining it makes it so much simpler. That's all.
Makes a lot of sense. Intermittent fasting, I wanted to pick your brain on this. What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting for people who are, because what I find, I had this chat with Ted, is people sometimes use it for the wrong reasons. They want to lose weight. They might have struggled for a number of years to lose weight, and then they want to throw in fasting. And I always say, I don't think that's the best approach for most people, to be honest. What do you think the main benefits are of intermittent fasting? I'd love to know if like fat loss comes into that equation, or if you think there's other benefits which are more important.
No, I think it can be helpful. I think that the main benefit is by getting away from this idea that we have to eat all the time, maybe reduce the snacking. We know that, you know, it's pretty clear that most snack foods are not the most nutritious, high satiety foods around, probably often the opposite. You also maybe, if you do like 16-8 fasting, like you have an 8-hour eating window, which is quite popular, then maybe you're excluding breakfast and evening snacks, which also tend to be not the greatest foods for a lot of people. Certainly there are a lot of low satiety breakfasts and evening snacks around, that's for sure. But I think that the benefit beyond that is perhaps less impressive than at least I used to hope for and believe in. Because there's been a number of studies on intermittent fasting in the last few years, and the results have been a bit unimpressive, I think it's fair to say. So indicating that the effect of intermittent fasting is maybe not so profound on its own. And I think it comes down to really what foods are you eating when you eat? Because if you think that, hey, I can just fast for a day or two and then I can eat whatever I want, well, there is a risk then that you are losing all kinds of body mass when you're fasting, including muscle mass. But then when you're eating and you're super hungry and you choose these potentially these very low satiety, low nutrient foods, then you might be putting on mostly fat, so that you're actually making your body composition worse, potentially. Keeping the fat constant, perhaps, but losing muscle. I mean, that's the worst case. But in general, I think intermittent fasting can be a tool that is modestly helpful. And I do something like 16-8 most weekdays myself, partially because it saves me a lot of time. And as long as I eat highly satiating foods, I don't really feel a need to eat all the time. So it's easy, it saves time, and I think it does have a modest positive effect to get away from excessive snacking, for sure. So I'll give intermittent fasting a weak recommendation in favor of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes back down to the decisions you're making with food, right? I can only imagine if, for example, I do the same thing. I eat within roughly a 6 to 8 hour window. I have a lot of protein on both my meals, but if I was just to just eat what I wanted and just disregard, even though I don't have the desire to do that, I'm just thinking from the audience perspective, I just decided to just eat those snack foods that you mentioned, which generally are going to make us more overeat, more, you know, because more calorie density, less protein, everything else. It would not be a good idea, right? But you mentioned then about, I'd love to know why, because you said that the research is not really impressive when it comes to sustainable weight loss, for example, and health with intermittent fasting. Why did you say you thought that was? You thought that was because of the quality of food people are eating? Or is there any other factors that you think come into that, why it's not that effective?
No, I've just been unimpressed with the studies testing it. I mean, it can be helpful, no doubt, but when you compare it to other approaches for losing weight, it doesn't seem to have any significant edge to speak of. So again, I just had a big hopes for intermittent fasting. It makes sense, kind of. If you want to lose weight, don't eat. And if you want to lose faster, eat even more rarely. I mean, there is some logic to it. But then when you test it and you explore it and you see, probably there is, like Ted would say, you know, a U-shaped curve here, and that a little bit of intermittent fasting can be great, but too much can be harmful. And it's about finding the sweet spot. Like it's eating too often isn't great, obviously, for weight loss or for metabolic health, but eating, spreading it out to too few meals may also have negative effects, so that there is a sweet spot. And probably, I would say, eating at least twice a day may be beneficial for most people if you want to maintain a good body composition. Once a day or more rarely than that may not be optimal. I mean, some people do well on once a day, so I'm not saying it's a bad idea necessarily. But I think for lean mass, for muscle mass, my take on the evidence is that most people will probably get more lean mass by eating at least twice a day.
Mm. Awesome. And the thing is, I was just thinking in my head then, it's almost like a bit of a shortcut, right? Fasting, it sounds really, really good on paper. But if it's someone who's been struggling with their weight for years, metabolic health, maybe behaviors of food, you're going to have to focus on those big rocks. There's no, you can't really cut around those things in terms of protein percentage, because if you haven't got that as a habit where you're naturally wanting to have a certain amount of protein each meal, you're just going to be fighting a losing battle, I think, regardless of intermittent fasting or not. You know what I mean? Most of the time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's true. I think the same thing goes for calorie counting. I'm not a big fan of that, clearly. But, you know, if people want to do it, perhaps it can be a bit of an assistance. But it really comes down to what you eat. I mean, if you are counting calories, then to eat fewer calories, what you basically have to do is eat better foods. And if you don't, then you can only manage to do it probably for a short time. And eventually, yeah, as I mentioned, you get tired, you get more cravings, you're just going to give up eventually. So the only way to make it work is to eat better, more satiating foods, And then why not just do that in the first place?
I agree. I'm not sold into the kind of time restricted eating. And again, it can have benefits, of course, but I'm not sold into the time restricted eating or intermittent fasting in terms of when they say it's more important when you eat, as you know, that's more important than what you eat. There's just, it just doesn't make any sense to me. You know what I mean? Circadian rhythm, no, that, that's really important. That's, yeah, but they do say that. You do hear that a lot, don't you?
That's a very attractive message for some people.
Really attractive.
Unfortunately, I think it kind of sells it in a nice way. Makes people feel like, oh, I can eat whatever I want and I can still be super successful. It's what people want to hear, but unfortunately, it's probably not true.
I wanted to switch gears and just ask you something not relating to nutrition, right? Hot cold therapy. This is a bit of a random question, but I was just thinking earlier, I got back into doing saunas and ice baths just earlier on, actually. And I thought, you're in Sweden. They've done some interesting studies in Scandinavia in terms of longevity genes and stuff like that. And they've related that to some of the hot cold stuff that you guys or up in Scandinavia, they tend to do more frequently. Is that something you do? I'm just curious to know if you think it is beneficial. If we're looking at, again, if we go back to the fundamentals, I would say this is at the bottom of this when it comes to overall health. You want to focus on your nutrition, your sleep, your exercise first, of course. But do you do it? And do you think it's effective, you know, doing that? Is it kind of common up there, up in Sweden?
I wouldn't say it's common. I mean, some people do it. I'm not a big fan. I don't really do that currently. I mean, I've been experimenting a little bit with it for fun, but no, I'm not an expert on that. I don't do it much.
Okay. I was just curious because I just assumed in my head that everyone does it up there, but it's not.
Well, we do have a cold weather.
Yeah, exactly. You just plunge into those cold waters. Good luck with that.
It happens naturally.
Exactly. This has been absolutely awesome. So many knowledge bombs here for the audience and so many insights. And again, you broke it down in such a simple, effective way. Tell us a bit more about what you're doing now. And if you've got anything to share in regards to the Harvard app, or any insights on that, because it looks like it will be, it probably already is going to be revolutionary from my conversation I had with Ted. I think there's got so much potential, man.
Yeah, I really think it will be. And that we already have built something that is quite special, really with the focus on making it simple to eat better. And for example, I mean, it's about satiety. It's about getting people to not have to look at all these details, all these nitty gritty, all these percentages here and there and grams and blah, blah, blah. You can just boil it all down to one scale and see where you are. And then it's about how do we make it really, really simple? Because tracking foods and using nutrition apps can be very boring. I know I've done it a lot. And I think that very time consuming and frustrating. But currently, I mean, for me, I only use our app. I try others most days just for comparison. But long term, I only use ours. And the biggest one thing, there are many things, but the biggest one thing is making it possible to just track by taking a picture of the food you eat. And this is new AI technology that became available just a few months ago that I think we are leveraging better than anybody in the world right now. And I'm really proud of the team for making this work as well as it does. For me, it's a complete game changer. Instead of spending minutes and, you know, not having fun either, trying to figure out how much of this and that ingredient is in this food I just ate and trying to type it in, which is just pretty miserable, really. You can just take a picture and 9 times out of 10, it's just good enough for our purposes. If not, you can just easily tweak it and either way you save 80% of the time. So for me, that's a complete game changer. I would just never use a nutrition app that doesn't have that functionality. And currently we do it, I haven't seen anybody even close really to what we do. So that to me is the number one, like mind-blowing improvement from any other system. So just take a picture of what you eat and you can see what's in it. You can see the satiety of it. You can also see protein, calories, carbs, whatever else you're looking for. So many other improvements coming up, but I think that is really the total game changer.
I'm going to have to test that out myself, to be honest, because I do have, not all of my clients, but some of them track now. And I tracked on and off for about 6 years, and it is, because I used to do bodybuilding and everything else, probably about 6 years on and off. And it's never fun. Miserable is the right word, right? Unless you've got some sort of disorder and you really enjoy it. You know what I mean? Like I used to have for a period of time.
It just sucks. Really, I would never want to do it. But now, I mean, I've been doing it every day, every meal for since late last year, everything. And it's just so easy now.
So you literally and take... I mean,
there are some studies coming out just recently came out showing that actually people who track what they eat daily, they lose much more weight than people who don't. In this study, they tracked people who had been on the weight loss program for 3 months, and then they followed them up for 9 months after that, recommending that they track their foods. And I found that people who didn't or just did it once a week or something, then they started regaining clearly. People who did it a few days a week, they maintained. But people who did it 5, 6, or 7 days a week, they kept losing. Even after the weight loss program, they just kept losing. And of course, this is observational. We don't know exactly cause and effect, but it's clear that people who do are more successful. And I think it makes perfect sense because when I do, I care more about what I eat. I spend a little bit extra time thinking about it. And also I learn a thing or two. Like I think what our app does that nobody else really does, which is really the foundation of it, you leave the cool picture logging aside, is that it teaches people what effect different foods have. Because what everything else does is what's just wrong, what's just caused us to start doing this in the first place is everybody else is just looking at calories, how much are you eating? But that's the result. That's not the cause of how much you eat. That's just the result. And what you should really focus on is the thing that drives whether you become satiated or hungry. And that's the satiety per calorie of the food, the satiety effect of the food you're eating. Like how much does it promote overeating or satiety? And that's what you learn by using our app. You can see for every food that you eat or every food you search for or look for, you can see how satiating is it? Will it cause you to eat more or cause you to eat less? And then what you can do is just look at the foods you eat and then you try to eat more of the highly satiating foods that you already eat and love. Just eat more of them. And that will automatically cause you to eat less of other things. So basically you don't have to make a super big change and you know, exclude all kinds of foods or go on a radically different diet, start eating completely different foods. Just keep eating the foods that you already eat, just more of the best ones. And I think that's a key benefit of this approach.
Man, it sounds awesome. I'm going to have to test it out. I might even get my girlfriend's tracking right now. I might get her to test it out first and see how she goes with it. If you're looking, you know, say someone who's looking to build muscle and everything else, they want to eat more. Does it still actually compute the calories and everything else? Or does it just tell you?
Yeah, you get everything. Everything you get in other apps, you get that too. You get the calories, you get the protein grams, you get everything.
Insane. Yeah, I think that's going to be a real game changer, man. Hey, really appreciate your time, Andreas. Where can the audience find you?
Well, they can go to our website at hava.co or I'm very active on X, I guess. So Dr. E on X. That's where to find me.
Thanks a lot for your time. Really, really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Andreas. Absolute pleasure.